Hello and welcome to the Ludic Insights podcast. This series explores themes and topics relating to all things digital and digital's impact on our society's leadership and ways of getting things done. My name is Garrick Jones and I'm from the Ludic Group and I'm a co-author of the book Alive, Digital Humans and Their Organizations, available on Amazon, Kindle and bookstores near you. I'm here with my co-author and fellow business partner Paul Ashcroft.
Hi there.
And we're delighted today to be joined by Dina Domet from Ashridge, talking about digitizing executive education.
Thank you, Garrick and Paul. It's great to be here.
We saw each other recently. We go back a long way, don't we?
We do,
We've known each other for years in different contexts and bumped into each other in Venice, of all places, recently.
Yes, yes, that was very exciting. I was on holiday with my husband, and you, of course, were there for the Venice Biennale. And I remember you came up to me in the BA lounge and said, I know this person.
I know this person.
And then before I could get your name out, you said mine. And we said, we must reconnect.
And here we are.
Here we are.
Doing
here
a podcast, actually put together by a third friend of ours. So
indeed.
It's just a brilliant serendipitous indeed. Kind of moment. Such a pleasure to have you. And interesting, I'm really interested in talking about digital and executive education. But the thing I want to explore first is why. Why is executive education important to this topic about the digital and where we're going?
Marvelous. Well, do feel free to pile on and pile in. I love this theme. It's perfect for us. I don't know if your listeners know Ashridge. It is in a beautiful estate. It is out in Hertfordshire, and it's near Berkhamsted. Beautiful old house. Ashridge House goes back about 800-900 years, and it has been associated with the royal family. It was Henry VIII's hunting lodge. It was where Queen Victoria grew up and planted a tree that we still honor today. So why would I talk about digital executive education when I work at a place that looks like an old Oxford college or a monastery? The reason I will is because I first came to know Ashridge about 2 decades ago as a client. Executive education has been part of my career now for over 2 decades. I'm American, as you can hear. And I had been working at Columbia Business School in the 1990s. And then I was tasked with a fun project to set up a partnership with a school or in the UK. I didn't know Ashridge yet, but I ended up partnering between Columbia and London Business Schools. Then, as you do, I got headhunted to work in leadership development for a big company called Marconi. And this was in 2001. And the CEO turned to me and said, Dina, you know a lot of business schools. Who is doing something really innovative in leadership development, in executive education? And one of my colleagues said, you need to visit Ashridge. You need to talk to them. So this was in 2001. I visited the gorgeous campus, but the hook was that they had an online learning library, which we still have today.
Oh, really?
And we now call it Virtual Ashridge. Back then, I'm not sure if they had a snazzy name for it, but I was touched by something. So I worked for Marconi, and we were having tough times. This was the dot-com bubble bursting. We were a technology and a telecoms company, just trying to stay afloat. I remember speaking to the people at Ashridge, and the first thing they asked me was not how much will you spend or can we take you on as a client. It was, how are you? I was really struck by this. They cared that I was in a company that was potentially in free fall. And they did have a solution for me with this online library, but they didn't push hard on that. What they presented to me was, well, we have a range of learning opportunities. You see the campus. They did short courses there. Yes, they did custom work. But what they had that I really needed was this online learning library. So I subscribed to that and to Harvard Managed Mentor, thinking it was a slam dunk, going back to my CEO and saying, I've got Harvard and I've got Ashridge. And he actually kind of made a face at Harvard. And he said, and I thought to myself, I got a great deal on both. I can't go back to Harvard and say no. And he said, well, that's okay. But make the Harvard logo small and big up Ashridge.
Wow.
And I asked him why. And he said, well, Ashridge is the right brand for us because it's a down-to-earth organization, and we know that we'll be in good hands with learning experts. So the weekend we loaded it on our intranet, it crashed the intranet because we had, of our 50,000 employees, thousands of them wanted the lessons that were on there.
Yeah.
So then fast forward, you know, 2 decades later, near about a couple of years ago, I was working at Oxford University, their excellent business school. And someone rang me and said, they're looking for a dean at Ashridge. Do you know what Ashridge is? I said, certainly I do. It is now part of Holt International Business School. Do you know Holt? Certainly I do. and I was a little surprised they were interested in me. And mysteriously, they said, no, they want you. It specifically has to be you. Don't know why. So I went up there and...
I know why.
Hey, oh, lovely. We worked together. It's kind of you to say. I went there. It was a beautiful snowy day. And then it all came flooding back, my memories of, okay, yes, Ashridge, but reconnecting with the notion of the digitized executive education that I needed 20 years ago.
And they were way ahead of the game.
They were,
they
absolutely.
Really were. I remember process, I want to really understand a little bit more about the sort of virtual Ashridge and that. And we can explore that in terms of how we think about digital humans and learning as a life skill and so on going forward. But I still remember, you know, 20 years ago, we were doing a lot of work with the Santa Fe Institute at the time on complexity and Stuart Kaufman and all that lot, and finding new ways of taking these kind of models, you know, ant-based algorithms and so on, and putting them into organizations as part of consulting jobs, I remember. But it was Ashridge which had that kind of skill set, information theory, academics in the UK. They were ahead of the game then.
Absolutely.
And they really understood about systems and how you create very large feedback networks within systems. And that seems to have informed a lot of the decision-making that was going on then.
Definitely. And so we're a perfect partner with Holt International Business School because they came along in 2015 and allied with us. So we are effectively their executive education campus. And they have campuses in all the cities I care about and have lived or worked. London, Boston, Dubai, Shanghai, and San Francisco. And so we are their castle out in the countryside. And another reason I like the topic, digitizing executive education, if you don't mind, my subtitle is Humanizing Executive Education in the Age of Automation.
Nice.
Because being digital, well, it means a lot of things. You know, what do you guys think? When you first started thinking about and hearing the word digital, what did it mean for you?
Yeah, I really want to pick up on this because our experience of working with executives, learning and educating with executives is actually they don't necessarily want to be digital. They want a face-to-face experience. They want to meet with their peers. They want to connect with each other. That's the value of it. And I'm fascinated that you said the thing that attracted you to Ashridge was they were interested in you.
Yes.
So, and it's one of the themes that we've been exploring in this podcast more and more is that as we become more digital, we need to stay human and keep to be more human. Is Ashridge still doing that?
Yeah. Well, for me, digital means easier access. And for me, digital goes back to my first job out of graduate school. I worked at a place in New York City in the heart of Manhattan, right next to the famous 21 Club. And it was then called the Museum of Television and Radio. And I remember then we had a collection of, they still do, a collection of radio and television programming. And they were switching from analog to digital. And this was a big deal, talking about how we were going to swell our library and capture everything that could be captured for the general public to enjoy. And then we use it. I ran the education department, and we use it in teaching little 90-minute seminars, customizing the experience based on, you know, did somebody want to look at the moon landing? Did you want to look at civil rights? Mm. One of my favorites, there were two favorites, teaching a course on stereotypes on TV. And one of my best educators was a brilliant guy who was a playwright, and he was gay himself. He was really good at connecting with tough kids from the Bronx. And one time he did, it was a prison. They sent prisoners to the museum. And he did the session on stereotypes on TV, and he showed a clip about a young boy realizing he's gay. And he was watching their reactions, and they had bonded with him so much, but that by the end of the session, he said, well, I'm gay, and how do you feel about that? How do you feel about me? It was moving, sitting in the back of the classroom, hearing him do that. And I'm Italian-American. I don't mind, but so much of TV and media is about mafia stereotypes. Right. Look, they're there, and they exist, and there's no point pretending they don't. But there needs to be a counterpart to these things. So I liked the stereotypes course, and I loved we had a course we called Nostalgia, where we would show programming from the original golden age of television, although I think we're in one now too. And we would do this for pensioners. And one time I had a guy in the audience had actually been involved in the moon landing. He was a technician working on it, so he was so excited. So for me, though, digital is just a different way to connect with the past and planning ahead for the future. So little did I know it back in the mid-90s when I worked in this beautiful little temple to television. It's now called the Paley Center for Media, but it's still thriving. I didn't know that was, for me, the start of doing executive education. So customizing a learning experience to an audience, and you wouldn't even get, back then I didn't get that much advance notice. You know, they'd book it.
You've talked a lot about media, yes. And you've talked a lot about customization. And yes. I guess those are two themes that need to emerge when we talk about exec ed. And I'm interested in, I'm interested in learning. I'm interested in education and lifelong learning and all the rest of it. But if you think about the executive, customization and media, what do you think, Dina, is the, if we imagine, what is the state-of-the-art experience for an executive?
Yeah.
Oh, and we talk about learning journeys and so on, but that probably muddies the water. But what is the state of the art if we had everything we could dream of?
Yes.
For a busy executive in this day and age, using every possible resource that we've got.
The essence is knowing yourself. And Ashridge has always specialized in leadership being beginning with great self-awareness. If you understand and lead yourself first, then you can understand and lead others. So I think the cornerstone of every great executive education program, every great learning experience, is bringing it back to yourself. And I think we are in quite a solipsistic age nowadays. Everything is kind of about me. Social media allows you to do that. But that's okay. You really need to focus on yourself. And we teach that it's not just about your intellectual awareness. It's also your social awareness and your physical awareness. So we have a series of programs that rely on doing assessments that measure how your body reacts to things. So I've just gotten trained to be a facilitator using HRV, heart rate variance testing. So I've just had the monitor on myself a few weeks ago, and then I went through my debrief, and it's the kind of test you can't game. So when you see how resilient are you and under what conditions are you stressed, how do you handle that, we always find that our participants are surprised by what they find. So really, it comes down to a deep self-awareness. And for me, what's different about Ashridge is we take all of the learning tools available to us and focus on the individual and then widen out the circles so that they are relating to their peers on the course and then thinking about the people back home and on the job that are not there with them. So I've noticed that when we teach on a program, it's quite common that people get very emotional about it and they will come away at the end of the day or the end of the week saying, oh, I'm going to use this with my teenage son to reconnect with him. Or, you know, there was one client. We have quite prominent clients from around the world and one big state-owned Chinese enterprise, big energy company. They're in this week, actually. So I do the welcome, and then I'm on the faculty panel at the end of their two-week journey and their module where we learn what they learned in this Essentials of Leadership course. The first time I was on that faculty panel, I had to stifle a chuckle when one of the senior executives said, what I have learned is to be patient with myself and my employees. The next time I'm angry with an employee, instead of screaming at them, I will count to 10 and I will be patient. And now we might stand back and think, how silly, did they not already know that? Well, you know, even today, in this day when people are supposedly mindful, you still have bullying bosses. You still have people who are not aware that driving yourself hard and driving other people hard is not the answer to productivity. And so for us, as I say, it's humanizing executive education in the age of automation. A lot of our senior executives worry about their careers. And do we? Do you ever worry? Has there been a time in your life when you've thought, I better be aware of this digital tsunami?
I mean, it's a great question, because the reason Paul and I ended up where we are today, you know, having written these books and, you know, running these five companies and all the rest of it, and doing this podcast series, amongst other things, is because about 10 years ago, I think now, Paul, about 10 years ago, we looked at the range of products that we had, which were very face-to-face, very large-scale. We were famous for our large-scale decision-making, systems-based stuff for enabling very large-scale change, but it was incredibly analog. Even though we had the internet and we were doing a lot of things with media and digital, it was within a face-to-face, you know, people were flying 150 people across the world. You know, this was costing a fortune, very effective. But we had a conversation which was essentially, I can't imagine us doing this 10 years from now. This has got to shift. How do we build the platform that would allow us to achieve the same things, results we get from people being together online? And that was a journey that began, and you know, it's gone all over the place. But now we have a Smart Lab platform, which is phenomenal and is really starting to scale. But that's how we ended up here. We were afraid that our business had no future being analog, and so we thought we had to decide small steps back then to kind of, and here we are today. Which is, would you agree?
Yeah, definitely. And one of the things that we knew happened is people had a great experience when they came together. And it sounds, Dina, this is what you're describing. People come together, they have a powerful, perhaps even life-changing experience from what they're learning, but also the connection with each other. Then when they go back and apply that outside of that learning environment, what's the impact? Does it drop off? Do they remember? How is it reinforced? And certainly we've seen that the digital can help continue to maintain those communities, continue to help provide tools and learning. What's Astrid seen here?
So definitely. So we have programs that are entirely virtual. We rely quite heavily on Zoom video. We have faculty who are great at facilitating breakout sessions over Zoom. We do have learning management systems. We experiment with several. We want to know about your Smart Lab. But what I've noticed is I don't see a big difference between the face-to-face learning and the virtual. Now, some of my academic colleagues might think I'm being a turncoat. I do believe in face-to-face education, but I have a personal reason why I know that digital can keep you connected. I'm an identical twin, and she lives home in Connecticut where I'm from, and I am here in England, obviously. I'm here for 2 decades. She's actually just arrived today. My husband met her at the airport, and I will see them tonight for dinner. There are two of us. So, and in fact, that can confuse people. There are technically even 4 of us. I have 2 other sisters, and we all have this very distinctive low voice, lower than our brothers in some cases. But anyway, my relationship, my bond with my twin is as close today, even though we don't live together. And we were very close to our mother. We were the youngest of 6 kids. And my mother lived to be 92, but she ended up having dementia. But you're not aware of it. You kind of don't want to see that. She had a mild dementia, and she knew me up until the end. And I think and know that the reason is I rigged several computers in her house in Connecticut to turn on automatically using Skype back then. So she didn't have to figure it out, and she would just get my disembodied voice and then my image. And she always knew me. She knew me right up until the end. And the nurse said, well, you know, why don't you? You know, you were present in her life all the time. Yeah. It probably helped that I looked exactly like my twin sister. But do you know, they are doing research on this and experimenting with Alzheimer's patients, this kind of thing. And I was hearing on BBC4, they were talking about using virtual reality. And I thought, you don't need to make it that complicated. It is as simple as having a digital photo frame with images of people that you want them to remember.
That's right. And connectivity. Yeah. It's all about connectivity. It's all about keeping the brain alive and keeping the relationships alive with people.
Yeah.
So it makes perfect sense.
Thank you for listening to The Alive, Digital Humans and Their Organizations podcast. You can subscribe to this podcast and explore previous episodes on iTunes, Spotify, and all major podcast hosting sites. Search Ludic Insights.
Does Astrid manage to put this into the journeys and the programs they're doing with their executives? So beyond the face-to-face, connecting people with the right type of coach or the right type of faculty member?
Great question. Absolutely. So, and it is truly customized. It's not off the shelf. We diagnose the client's issues right from the get-go, and then we craft a solution that can include executive coaching, and that can be done virtually. It can be done face-to-face if they prefer it. I personally like doing the coaching over Zoom. I find that very soothing. I don't mind whether it's face-to-face in person. We also care about the environment, so we do encourage as much of the activity to happen online. There's a lot of work that happens between the face-to-face modules. Because the campus is so beautiful, and we do incorporate in our teaching walks around the grounds, It is true that so many of our participants would never want to miss that. And my colleagues always want to teach in that beautiful space. But we make sure we make good use of the intercessions. And we found that for several of our programs, we use, there is an approach where we will work with the client to identify their strategy and what their desired outcomes are of the learning. And sometimes it culminates in teams of the delegates doing project presentations in front of a very senior audience. I've contributed to those. I will be going to a final module teaching that in a few weeks' time in Brussels. The way to really generate a great presentation is to give them lots of opportunities to rehearse. And we wouldn't come to them face-to-face to do that. So the digital platforms that we use, they should be, and they are, so seamless that you don't notice it. So over the weekend, I saw the film Ad Astra. Mm. I don't know if you've seen this yet.
Not yet.
I won't spoil it, but what
it's
I like...
It's on our bucket list.
What I like about it is that you take it completely for granted that it's the near future and people fly to the moon as if you are going to Venice. And it is, the technology is...
And you bump into your friends in the lounge.
You bump into your friends. And hopefully not into your father with whom you might have issues. But anyway, it's a good film. But watching it, though, I also had this kind of moment. It's been a week. So my husband and I, we were, you know, children of the 60s and the moon landing. So we were out celebrating the moon landing, the 50th anniversary this past July. Remember, there was a beautiful lunar eclipse, actually.
There was.
So I think somehow I see that as fate and destiny. And last week we went to see Professor Brian Cox do his show Universal, and he's amazing. One of his idols is one of my idols, Carl Sagan. So the American physicist had a program called Cosmos back in the day. But what I wonder is, it has felt to me that, so the film Ad Astra, it has elements of 2001, and it reminded me of Arthur Clarke's fiction. And I find, this is a bit grandiose, but to me, the metaphor for the work we do at Ashridge is like the monolith in 2001.
Oh, yes.
Which it doesn't interfere with humanity, it's sparking humanity to reach the next level.
Just the fact that it's there.
Right? And you remember the apes, they can't quite touch it. Their hands skitter around it. But that the monolith stands for sparking man to a higher level of consciousness.
So that's a great segue for my next question, which is digitization has happened globally. In the last, 20 years, it's everywhere. It's changed our lives. We can hardly imagine 10 years ago that the internet was not as pervasive as it is, all the way through to our, everyday lives and ordering, shopping, and not just for communicating an email. That being said, leadership has got to deal with new kinds of organizations, new kinds of networked organizations, new kinds of tribes. A new reality is fast emerging. What do you think is the advice for leaders who tackling this reality?
Yes.
And what kind of skills do you think we need to have on board that we may not have been
Absolutely.
Focused on? Because MBAs come out of, a lot of MBA training, you could argue, is maybe 20 or 30 years old.
I have a good answer for that. I wouldn't be a good dean if I didn't plug a few books for my faculty. So one of the things I love about Ashridge, our faculty, they're not typical. They've all had industry backgrounds. A fair few have been psychologists. So instead of studying finance and economics, we are studying the science of humanity. So they are social scientists and experimenters. And several of our faculty have books out just this month and this year. Guy Lubich, a fabulous Israeli professor, is co-authoring a book with his sister, who is a psychologist herself, and their book is called Connect, How to Make Effective Relationships at Work. We have other faculty. Amy Bradley has a book coming out this December called The Human Moment, The Importance of Compassionate Leadership. We have other faculty, Barbara Wong, who is a star managing our big Chinese clients. She's just come out with a book, Guangxi in the Western Context. Another faculty member, Dr. Vicky Culpin, and our former dean, she is a research scientist from an earlier life, has become a psychologist. She's written a book, The Business of Sleep, How Sleeping Better Can Transform Your Career. What these books, I think, have in common is focusing, as I said earlier, on yourself and on the people around you. We have another faculty member, Vlaka Hlupic, who I've just recruited, and she has written a book called Humane Capital, and it's all about, it's case studies of how she has worked with companies to reach this higher level of managerial consciousness and enlightenment. And her book came to the attention of the Dalai Lama, who praised it for its enlightened approach to management. Peter Drucker famously said that managing is about doing things right, and leadership is about doing the right thing. And I think that's something that we try to emphasize at Ashridge. But remember my image of the monolith in 2001. We don't want them to see the join. We don't want our participants to be so self-conscious that they're learning theory. It needs to be that they're experiencing something in a deeply personal way. So we think that the skills and the attributes you should have in the 21st century start with humanity. And be the best person you could be. I mean, it sounds trite, but be the best person from all aspects. We do a lot of 360 feedback assessments that get you to think about yourself as a leader, as an individual contributor, but also, as I said, this physiological element. And for me, that really has been mind-breaking. So the notion that the way we acted in the 80s was not the way to be. So the powerful
double martini lunches, yeah. And
command and control.
Exactly.
Don't power on through. So, and in the movie,
Leave the cigars at home.
And in the movie Ad Astra, Brad Pitt's character is famously calm. It's one of the reasons he's chosen to do this difficult mission. And it's a film, you know, it's a character. So can we really be like that? But actually you can find, and we teach our executives this, you can be mindful if you spend 10 minutes a day being mindful. Megan Rates is one of our faculty members who's written a book called Mindfulness. And her latest book is called Speak Up, When to Say What Needs to Be Said and Hear What Needs to Be Heard. So another feature of the 21st century leader is somebody who doesn't just talk, but listen.
It's a fascinating list. I imagine if we asked you this question even 10 years ago, certainly 20 years ago, there would be a different list of books that you would be recommending to.
And I'm not sure the Dalai Lama would have picked one of those from 10 years ago. This is.
We're talking about digital leaders.
I think I say yes. And I think Ashridge was ahead of their time, as Garrick, you kindly said earlier. They were ahead of their time digitally, but also in terms of the kinds of research they did. So they were dealing with mindfulness before it was a cool thing to do. And I will confess, my earlier self thought, no, you do just have to power through. You know, you do need to work hard. My parents were that greatest generation that lived through the Depression and fought in World War II. But we don't want our children to go through that experience. You want to be successful and comfortable. You don't want to go through hell. So Ashridge, again, remember when I met them 20 years ago, their question to me, how are you? How are you? And then I came away from that experience. The next time somebody rang me up at Marconi trying to sell me something, I started to say, did you even stop to think, how am I doing today? Have you read the news? Have you looked on the internet to see what's happening to our share price? And if they hadn't, you know, I would give them an earful and I would put the phone down.
I was fascinated by the, you know, you talk about the three things, the social, the intellect, of course, and then you talk about the physical.
Yes.
But at one level, you're also talking about the metaphysical.
Yes.
I don't want to say the spiritual. Maybe I do say the
spiritual. You do want to say the spiritual. Of course you do.
I do want to say that. But so there is the spiritual component. And what's interesting to me is that what we're saying is that the digital future and the digital executive is being augmented in your learning by the digital is one thing, but what you're learning, the content, is the most important thing. Focus on the physical. That's what Paul encourages me to do as a business partner. Make sure I'm in the gym 3 or 4 times a week. He calls it his investment, which is which makes sense and which I'm very grateful for. But also, you know, the content of being mindful, being aware of your intellectual capacity, your technical capability, but also the social, and fundamentally this metaphysical. You would talk a little bit more about how that plays out in a kind of, why is it a difficult question? Because we all come from different belief sets,
yes,
different backgrounds,
yes,
different religious backgrounds or non-religious backgrounds. Yes. How does that play out?
I'm glad you use the word metaphysical, because I think that is the additional dimension here. leadership 4.0 is going beyond just the original age of automation. So I think where the metaphysical element plays out is, no, you're right, we don't have the same religion or any religion at all, but we, I think, are striving for some higher good. And you have some awareness that I need to be better than I am. I want to be more than I am right now. We're living longer, so it makes sense that you want to think about your own personal evolution and your spiritual development. That does sound a bit high-minded, but I do think that it's why our it's why our participants do share back with their families what they've learned on a course with us, and why we have, I would say, we do a lot of our work with very senior executives, with CEOs and boards, but also with mid-level executives and high-potential employees. And I think there has been an evolution in how companies are looking at their talent. You mentioned things are changing. We don't have the same hierarchies that we used to have. So the executives that come to see us, they need to be nimble. So they need to be able to grasp this digital revolution and be proficient in it, because the next generation that comes already takes that very much for granted in a way that we didn't. But what is that doing to you? You know, what's that doing to you as a human being? Do you feel minimized by it? Yeah. I think you shouldn't. I think you should feel enhanced by it.
Where is the opportunity? Paul and I write in our book a chapter on what we call the pyramid shift, and how the pyramid has now broken away into a cloud, essentially, of extended relationships, hyper-connected, where there is the opportunity for as much information to flow in to this the smallest member of a tribe or organization as distinct from somebody who's in the most senior positions. So there is a connection that didn't exist, and also a relationship that now exists. That didn't. What does that mean for leaders, do you think, in terms of the skill sets?
Yeah. So I think leaders, they have to be self-aware and hopefully not too self-conscious, but it's hard to be one without the other. They have to be mindful of the fact that it would be easy for employees at any level of the organization to connect with them. And I think a truly evolved leader will not fear that. Will find a way to really connect with their own organization and with their customers. So we've been speaking for a while. We haven't talked about customers. We all have them. So we certainly have customers at Ashridge. I think we tend to speak of them more as partners and clients and delegates and participants, but effectively, these are people who are buying our services. And the executives that we serve, they have companies that rely on customers at the end of the day. So, you know, on a practical level, I think the digital revolution has brought so much to the day-to-day consumer that we didn't have 30 and 50 years ago. I mean, I wish my father had lived to see the day when even personal copiers were common. I remember he would have wanted that back in the 1970s and 80s. Can you imagine? And then here's my little mother living to age 92 because medical advances were such that she could be well cared for. But she still needed the humanity of my sister, making sure that she had the best care. And then again, as I said earlier, the way we used technology to stay connected and keep it real. So I think that CEOs, leaders, people at the very top of organizations need to be very, very self-aware. And did they always need to be? Not really. Remember, in the age of heroic leadership, we would teach and we would say that, well, a great leader, you know, is born. You can't be taught to be a great leader. I don't really think you can be taught to be a great leader, but everybody can be self-aware.
Paul and I were in Prague a couple of weeks ago at Futureport Prague, where we had a great time. We were asked to lead one of the stages for a couple of days. And we were talking to Gary Bowles from Singularity University.
Wow, yes.
A great guy who's fascinating to talk with. And he reminded us that these notions of leadership and executive management and stuff go back to Alexander the Great.
Correct.
Where, you know, you needed hierarchies to get information to go throughout the kingdom as quickly as possible. Sometimes 2 years before it all trickled down. But that has shifted fundamentally. Yes. But what hasn't shifted, you know, is the need to be self-aware and to be charismatic in your own way by being authentic. You know, when you read any account of Alexander the Great, who is sort of a hero of mine, any account of him talks about his humanity and how he was very much a man of the people and how he inspired the people around him because he was so human, and they all remembered his humanity, his ability to get on a horse and run away and win a race, his ability to cry when people died, his ability to just spend some time with his people talking about what was going on. Of course, great leader, but how you ran all of Persia after he had overwhelmed them was something very different.
Yeah,
but he didn't have a personal computer.
No,
and he didn't have email, but we all do now.
No,
and we all have our own devices. That changes. That not only changes how we manage the system, it changes how we need to be in the system.
Yeah, but he also had a vision, and so technology will never be a substitute for that. Human
that
element
true?
of having
yeah.
seeing the bigger context. Yeah. I think that's a
he had the
point.
Greatest teachers in the world at the time too.
He did absolutely. And one more plug, if you'll permit me. So Allison Reynolds is another one of our great faculty members who has written a book that's coming out just this month. What Philosophy Can Teach You About Being a Better Leader. And so she looks at she and her fellow authors, colleagues of mine, ex-colleagues from London Business School, Jules Goddard, Dominic Holder, and David Lewis have explored lessons from Aristotle, Socrates, Kant, and Nietzsche. And now that may sound like a tough read. It isn't, actually.
No, that's Paul's Christmas
delightful.
Present sorted.
All right. Because she talks about, I asked Allison's advice about a session I am leading together with our chief engagement officer at Ashridge, a wonderful fellow Italian-American named Monet Uva, terrific lady. So Monet asked me for we do a kickoff session, a big party at the beginning of the year. So she wants us to talk about our core values. So I was speaking to Allison and she said, well, you know where values come from. I said, of course, it's from our philosophical origins here. And we muse a little bit about what does it mean to have core values? Does a company have to set them in order for you to live them? And I've asked some of our clients, well, what are your core values? What do you live by? And one terrific lady from British Land, used to work for British Land, and she still loves those values. And she said, you know them if you have them. If you really have them, you are already living them. So I think this is something that the great philosophers taught. And again, leaders from today, don't be afraid to pick up a book, whether in a physical form or a digital form. You still want to learn from the past as well as lead for the future.
I tell you what, there's a podcast in our future which is about what philosophy can teach us.
You're listening to The Alive, Digital Humans and Their Organizations podcast. Discover and download previous episodes on iTunes, Spotify, and all major podcast hosting sites. Search Ludic Insights.
I want to be devil's advocate for a second. So we've known leaders who have really excelled in this idea of changing and transforming the organization by changing the culture, focusing on values, focusing on how they are as leaders, which went extremely well until the share price started to go down and the business stopped making money quite as well as it did before. And my question for you is, what do you say to leaders who may see themselves in that position or face that position? It's fine to do mindfulness. It's fine to be a decent person when times are good. Is that still the thing to do when times are bad? I mean, yes, but how
great
do they
question,
manage those two things?
Great. So it goes back to what Drucker said, do the right thing. You should know to do the right thing. And doing the right thing, we would hope, would relate to a strong share price. But I would ask, too, the question, so organizations that seemed, it may be that they seemed to be leading the culture well, and it may be that their core values looked good and seemed good. But we have another concept that a couple of our faculty, they produced an article last December, and they came up with this topic. It was about team engagement in the workplace. And the BBC was all over this because what they identified was something called pseudo-engagement. And we've all seen this in an organization. Employees who, they talk the talk. They make sure they show up in front of the boss. They do what seems to be the kinds of things that get them noticed, but they're hollow. And I'll give you the names of all these faculty later, but Sharon Olivier and Amy Bradley produced this stunning research, and they've created a diagnostic to look at how are your teams really doing? So these core values, and usually they're apple pie lovely values. When I think of organizations that I've been affiliated with, the ones where I didn't even know we had values, and I realized I was living them. And I read an article somewhere that, oh yeah, so that is what we do. They need to not be hollow. So, you know, what great leaders have there been that stick to their values, stick to their principles? My favorite is Franklin Roosevelt's. For something, one of the things I love about Ashridge, now that we're part of HULT and then our sort of wider parent entity, EF, as in Education First, this company that was set up by Bertil HULT, from which we take the name of our parent school, they do fun things. And so they have fun values like nothing is impossible and passion and entrepreneurial spirit. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, all that stuff is good. But what we do because of HULT and EF is we dress up. We have a silly time. So our kickoff activity in a few weeks' time at Ashridge that Monet and I will be working on, and that Bjorn Bengtsson, our CEO, who comes from EF, both of them do, we are thinking about how are we going to engage and entertain our community. I think this is great. So it's, I think great leaders always pay attention to productivity, and certainly mine does. You know, he cares about how effective I am at squeezing good value out of our faculty. But I know that the way to do that is not to lash them with the whip. It is to motivate them
and
find out what makes them
tick. So the two things aren't mutually exclusive. You can
do both. They are not. They are not. I really believe this. And I've seen, I have to say, that the best, my model for a great leader was the dean at Columbia Business School. He's since semi-retired, but his name was Mayor Felberg. An amazing guy. And he was himself a great role model for being incredibly productive. He was up from 7 a.m. till midnight fundraising, leaving the rest of us to get on with the business of our work, whether it was executive education in my part or other people running the MBA. But he motivated us by his example. So a long-winded answer here, but I think you should not buy too much into the cults of the hero at the top of an organization. And Garrick, you asked earlier, you know, what should leaders do and what do they need to know about in an organization? I think they need to know that at every level of the organization, people are watching you. Don't fear it. Lean into it. And I hope that's what we help our participants do, but in a very, you know, human and selfless way.
So that idea of not being the anti-hero, but not taking on the pressure of being the hero.
Yeah.
Maybe working on just being yourself.
Yeah.
Or your best version of yourself.
Yes.
Without, then you talk about without the kind of pseudo thing like, oh, I'm being the best version of myself.
Yes.
No,
yes.
Here is who I am. This is what I am. And sometimes I make mistakes. And sometimes I need to apologize. And sometimes I need to lead.
Yes.
And allow other people to lead. It's all that thing about how do you, as you said right at the beginning of this, how do you find out who you are?
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm thinking about myself here, of course. How do you find out who you are? What's your best? What's your not so best? And and how do you plug the gaps? All the time trying to be human and remember the context in which other people are living and experiencing. I think, I mean, I don't know if we set out to do this, but we called our business Ludic, which when we look back now was kind of prescient in many ways. But the idea that play and being playful is part of... We're a very serious group of young people, I have to tell you. We're always working very hard. There's huge amounts going on. And then lots of smiles around the room now as I talk about this. Because I know how hard everyone works in this organization. The production is astonishing. And we're always got these deadlines and we're in exhibition mode. And, you know, things have got to go online and things have got to be produced. And clients have got to be satisfied and brought along on the journey and so on. But if we can remember that being playful along the way just makes it a lot easier.
We agree. So I think we're talking about serious play. So I've neglected to say so much of what Ashridge has always done, and I remember this 20 years ago, is a lot of great experiential activity. So we're constantly looking for new activities. Johan Roos, our chief academic officer from HULT, and a wildly charismatic Swedish guy, he is the co-inventor of something called Lego Serious Play, where we work with Lego blocks. That's an easy one to do. And you can tease out so many lessons out of what you built. A lot of people end up building Trump, which I think is funny. And then we take him apart in little blocks. Interesting metaphor for how people feel. Therapy. But it's that sense of serious play that all individuals should have. If you look at children, you know, you see how creative they are when they're young and they're not self-conscious. So I hope that we can all be part of a society where people are self-aware and just self-conscious enough to be their best selves without that seeming, you know, a little bit too twee. I've been in this country now 2 decades. I'm from no-nonsense New England, and I have that in common with Brits. And when I worked for Marconi, that was primarily a Northern European no-nonsense culture, Northern UK culture. And so I related, you know, very well to them. But now, you know, as I'm midlife, and who knows, hopefully I could live to be, well, I don't know if I want to live to be 100. you want to be, you know, very aware and in a way that helps other people be their best selves too.
Things Ashridge is known for is, as you were saying, know yourself, as you talked about, and therefore the customization of the experience of education. How is digital helping? How are you blending the physical with the digital to provide more and more tailoring and more and more personalization with the education that you provide?
Well, the digital platform allows people to prepare before they come to us. And I went through one of our programs because I wanted to experience it. So what I liked about that was you could engage with the online learning management system or not. It was up to you. You could just show up. And I think that's important, that we don't dictate that they need to be hyper-involved in the learning management system. But generally, most good delegates go through it. So you load your bio on there. You take a look at who the other people are. So it, first of all, helps you have a space to post your material, your information, which is much less static than it used to be when we used to hand out workbooks. So I love that. Then you get to see who else is on the course. And we've got a new group in. It's the second year that we're running an excellent program for a terrific international client. And I already see this group is more relaxed, there are literally a lot more Italians in this class and more women. Last year's cohort of 24 were quite serious, and this group is more playful. So there are two things we're doing for them. They can post their profiles online, and then we know some people want to do things face-to-face, so we do a marketplace where they have a poster, and they've done it, a digital version, and then they can come and bring things and post it up on a board in a physical room. So that's going on tonight. When I get back to Ashridge, I hope I will see what they've done. And it's a nice blend. So it's a combination of face-to-face and a reassurance. And I had dinner with them Sunday night, and they were nervous about a number of things, including that. Some of them said, well, I just have loaded up all my information, and I realize I'm making the career part the afterthought. Everything I put on there is my kids, my pets, my hobbies. And I said, that's great. Yeah. I wouldn't say that's wrong at all. Sure. And I said, if you have a question about that, don't worry. When you do the face-to-face, you will be able to supplement, but stick to your guns, you know? Mm. So that's a perfect example where we can do both. And then, as I mentioned, there's a client for whom we do, it's everything online. And we are learning from them about the best way to do online delivery and that sort of received education. So what makes it customized is that we always pay attention to how they're receiving this information.
Can you use data for this? Either finding out through a diagnostic, what people's learning styles are, where their content gaps are, what they're interested
absolutely.
In.
Absolutely, absolutely. So we do, most programs have an assessment. Usually they will have a 360 assessment. And so many executives, they sort of have assessment fatigue, right? So we try to keep it fresh. We have a number of our faculty who've created their own tools that help you figure out. One of them is called QI, in terms of the quality of your interactions with other people in the organization. So yeah, we give them data so that they can come away informed about how they're coming across and how their vision is being understood.
And track, I guess, how they are improving, how they're developing and go back on the long term.
Yeah. So for programs that we have that take place over a year, sometimes they're even 18 months, we make sure it's an iterative process. They evaluate us, we evaluate them. And then at the end of the experience, we give them a chance to reflect on how am I a better person? Am I a better manager? And love the way they're allowing us to include alumni from the past program. So we had one of the speakers Sunday night at the dinner was a lady who's based in the UK talking about how she really gave herself fully over to this process. Trust the process is what she said.
Dina Domet, Dean of Faculty at Hull Shattridge.
Thank you, yes.
It's great chatting to you.
Great
Brilliant
for me
conversation.
As well.
And I'm taking away this, humanizing exec education in the age of automation.
Thank you, that's perfect.
Great content.
All right.
So nice to see you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for being here. Thank you.